I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.
So just to say to begin, I want to share that while I was starting to work on this talk on gratitude, it was the week of the elections, and I was so grateful that I was writing about gratitude because I found myself really leaning into the practice to help myself feel a little better about some of the results that I didn't like. For instance, whenever I would start to feel really deflated about some of the bigger races that didn't go the way I expected, I would remind myself really consciously of the practice of gratitude, and I would consciously start reflecting on all the wonderful races that were so inspiring to me, and this would really help to lift my mood. I just kept having to do it over and over, really lean into that. Many of you, I think, in here took my MBSR workshop, and some of you then may know about the magnets that I used to hand out to people. It was from the textbook Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn. He was the founder of MBSR. And the quote was, "As long as you are breathing, there is more right with you than there is wrong, no matter how ill or how hopeless you may feel." And it's so true, and it's such a good reminder. This means that until the day that you die, really, there is always, it's so good to remember, there's always more right with you than wrong. I deeply, truly believe this. And the quote was resonating with me for quite some time, especially as I consider some recent fears that I've been having about the state of our nation and the state of our world, you know, about the ability, our collective ability of humanity to deal with things that are huge, like climate change or racism, war, disease, poverty, you know, all of these things. And so I've been rethinking that quote along these lines and rewriting it a bit so that it might look like this. As long as humanity exists, there is more right with humanity than there is wrong, no matter how ill or how hopeless it may sometimes feel, right? In a very similar way, I recently found these wise words that were comforting from the writer Nania Hoffman, who wrote, "In an increasingly uncertain and uncomfortable world, it helps to remember that there are still soft blankets and warm mugs and kind friends and good people, so many really good-hearted people who want the future to be better. If nothing else, take hope in that." You know? Because so often it's like, lately I've been just getting upset about the state of humanity. You know, so I have to remember that. And I think this is actually really tremendously important for us all to continue to believe, since as the teachings show us over and over, how we think about things can actually incrementally become how we see and relate to the whole world, and then how we manifest those actions out in the world. It's all connected. So the very first lines of the Dhammapada tell us, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. Yeah. As most of us also know from the teachings, the truth is that it is not the things that are happening all around us, or what people are doing, other people are doing all around us, that we'd really like to pin our happiness or unhappiness on these things most of the time. It is really about how we ourselves are relating and then responding to other people or whatever is happening around us that is going to determine our level of happiness or unhappiness, okay? And of course, this does not mean that there's never any pain in the world, right? So the first noble truth is there's suffering, you know, and there's a whole lot of it. But it doesn't mean all life is suffering, you know. And it doesn't in any way, of course, mean that we turn away from suffering or ignore it or try to put a happy face on it in some way. It's just that we tend to make the suffering, the inevitable suffering of life, so much worse by how we're relating to it, what we're believing about the suffering, and how we're perceiving the suffering. It's really all connected. And there's an old saying that points to the fact that being negative only makes a difficult journey more difficult. And this is, you may be given a cactus, but you don't have to sit on it. Isn't that good? It's so true. Another thing I think about a lot is this query from Albert Einstein. Many of you have heard this before. But this query is a little longer. He wrote, "I think the most important question facing humanity is the universe a friendly place? This is the first and most basic question all people must answer for themselves. For if we decide that the universe is an unfriendly place, then we will use our technology, our scientific discoveries, and our natural resources to achieve safety and power by creating bigger walls to keep out the unfriendliness and bigger weapons to destroy all that which is unfriendly. And I believe that we are getting to a place where technology is powerful enough that we may either completely isolate or destroy ourselves as well in this process. If we decide that the universe is neither friendly nor unfriendly and that God is essentially, quote, playing dice with the universe, then we are simply victims to the random toss of the dice and our lives have no real meaning or purpose. But if we decide that the universe is a friendly place, then we will use our technology, our scientific discoveries, and our natural resources to create tools and models for understanding that universe. Because power and safety will come through understanding its workings and its motives. God does not play dice with the universe." So with this in mind, you might really consider that question. You know, be really honest with yourself. Really be honest with yourself about how you think about it. Is the universe a friendly place? Right? Just to keep that thought in the mind this week and really be honest with yourself about it. And as you consider this, it might be also helpful to know that as humans, we are actually wired through our DNA to be Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. Right? So this has often been called our inherited negativity bias. So whenever we find ourselves, as you might this evening after that question, focused on the negative, it can be really helpful to remember that it's actually in our DNA and give ourselves a very big break for our negativity bias, since we don't want to beat ourselves up for beating ourselves up about something, right? It's a cyclical kind of thing. And it's also really helpful to remember that we inherited this negativity bias because our ancestors were smart. That can be helpful to remember, right? Thousands of years ago, they were almost constantly on the lookout for tigers and lions, actual tigers and lions that might leap on them, or fearful of other tribes who would steal their land and their food, right? And if they hadn't been this on the lookout for these things, they wouldn't have continued to live and thrive and multiply and pass on their genes to us. So they were smart. unfortunately, we're no longer being chased by actual tigers, you might notice, even in your daily life, that we tend to be constantly on the lookout for everything in our lives that can go wrong. Is that true? We're just constantly, like, fear is such an underlying thing for so many of us. And it's not only in the mind, it's truly visceral. It's in our bodies. And, of course, we know that the mind and body, they're not disconnected. And the Buddha taught us that through our practice, we must learn to embrace what are called the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, right? The full catastrophe, the whole thing. And yet, because of our negativity bias, we tend to somehow think that really it's more like 17,000 sorrows and only 3,000 joys, you know? So I'd like to invite you to just think about this for a moment and be honest with yourself, and you can take this through the week. And where are your thoughts most of the time? Just start to notice. You know, this is part of the practice. You know, are they filled with a sense of enormous abundance and gratitude for everything that's right in the world, you know? Or are they focused on every little thing that could be a threat or maybe something that needs fixing, right? Get that in your mind. This needs to be fixed, and this isn't right, and I got to do this, and I can't relax until this, until but, you know? Sometimes, I know I find myself sometimes waking up with the thought of, what do I need to fix today, right? Or what do I need to do? Or what might go wrong today, rather than waking up with a sense of, awesome, I have a brand new day. You know, what's going to happen that can be miraculous and amazing? What about all the news you may be watching? Or what is your news feed flooded with? Is your news feed, anybody who has Facebook on here, raise your hands. Most everybody, some people don't. Yeah, most everybody. So, you know, is it flooded with posts about abundance and joy and all the kindness and compassion that's been being offered? or, you know, is it every little thing that could be a threat or things that need fixing and this is wrong and catastrophe? You might also consider that because our perception as human tends to skew towards the negative, there's a very good possibility that we're not seeing the world as it is. It's always helpful to remember. Don't believe everything you think or even everything you see or read either, you know. So we need to maybe look at the world more accurately through clear glasses with more of a sense of balance. At the same time, it might also be helpful to know that modern science has shown that when we focus on what's wrong most of the time instead of what's right, this tendency actually creates actual grooves in our minds, the plasticity of the mind, and it makes it harder for us to step off those well-worn negativity paths. So think about when we're focused on the negative, we're actually creating literal grooves in our minds. So that's the bad news. The good news is science has also shown that through this particular practice that we're doing right here, right now, of training the mind and the body, we can literally change the way our mind works and how those paths manifest in the mind. So we can evolve. That's the good news. We can evolve, and this is how we do it, okay? The poet Dale Barron tells us, evolutionarily, we're always concerned with what's not right. That's what makes gratefulness delightfully subversive. I like that. It's subversive. I also love to remember a short phrase from the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, which is simply, suffering is not enough. Right? Suffering is not enough. So the idea is that, yes, there is suffering, of course, but our practice is not to live and dwell there, but to consciously cultivate lightness and joy so that we are going to be better able to step into the suffering when it happens, okay? It's going to help us with that. There's this wonderful story from Thich Nhat Hanh. It's from his famous book, Being Peace, which he wrote in 1987, which I think is still so relevant for us today, especially. And it's a little longer as a story. He said, many of us worry about the world situation. We don't know when the bombs will explode. We feel that we are on the edge of time. As individuals, we feel helpless, despairing. The situation is so dangerous. Injustice is so widespread. The danger is close. In this kind of situation, if we panic, things will only become worse. We need to remain calm, to see clearly. Meditation is to be aware and to try to help. I like to use the example of a small boat crossing the Gulf of Siam. In Vietnam, there are many people called boat people who leave the country in small boats. Often the boats are caught in rough seas or storms. The people may panic and boats can sink. But even if one person aboard can remain calm and lucid, knowing what to do and what not to do, he or she can help the boat survive. His or her expression, face, voice communicates clarity and calmness, and people have trust in that person. They will listen to what he or she says. One such person can save the lives of many. Our world is something like a small boat. Compared with the cosmos, our planet is a very small boat. We are about to panic because our situation is no much better than the situation of the small boat in the sea. You know that we have more than 50,000 nuclear weapons. Humankind has become a very dangerous species. We need people who can sit still and be able to smile, who can walk peacefully. We need people like that in order to save us. Buddhism says that you are that person, that each of you is that person. Each of you is that person. So Thich Nhat Hanh is really asking us, as is the Buddha, to train the mind, to really consciously train ourselves to become more peaceful and happy so that we can be that calm person, that really helpful, kind person in the storm. So I'm going to suggest that you make a more conscious, mindful effort to devote more of your mental space to celebrate and rejoice in ordinary things that are going right and things that you yourself are doing that are right. And remember that. Lean into that. So this is that training that is asking us to find the middle way, to discover balance in our views and in our perceptions of things. And again, to make a more mindful, conscious effort to focus on all the things that we see that are going right in our world, even the tiniest things, right? Like maybe something beautiful in nature, right? Some sunset, or some small or even large act of kindness that happens, something that contributes to a sense of love and community. And, you know, so often when things seem really difficult in our own lives or in the world or both, it can take a lot of effort to do this, but it's so worth it, you know. This is because, again, falling into a kind of despair isn't going to help you or anyone else, and it's not going to bring any kind of sense of calm or the compassion that's needed. One of my favorite writers is Barbara Kingsolver, and she writes about this kind of effort that's needed so beautifully. She says, in my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window, and then another, my daughter in a yellow dress, and another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon, until I learned to be in love with my life again, like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills. I have taught myself joy over and over again. I just think that's beautiful. So there are many ways that we can use our meditation practice to do this. And the first way is to really start noticing what in the mind is unwholesome and negative, and, you know, the thoughts that lead to the three poisons, greed, anger, aversion, delusion. And then consciously, very consciously replacing those thoughts with more wholesome thoughts that lead to more kindness and compassion and joy and ease, right? So we have to be aware first of what our minds are thinking and then shift them, consciously shift them. Thomas Bain, author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness, writes, "If you're out watering your flower garden by hand, you naturally concentrate the flow of water to benefit your beautiful flowers. If there's an area of weeds, you don't waste water there. As best as you can, avoid watering the weeds." It's the same with your consciousness. You can learn to selectively water the positive seeds and flowers in you. Sometimes we unwittingly water the weeds within us. We voluntarily expose ourselves to toxic and destructive things. When we're sad, we tend to feed the sadness by playing sad music, drinking too much, and rehearsing our sad thoughts internally and to anyone who can bear listening to us. Protect yourself from experiences that harm your consciousness. It's important to notice how things actually affect you and not let them colonize your consciousness, even if they're popular or critics say they're artistic. If you see this clearly, you won't want to continue exposing yourself to this kind of experience. There are many lovely things in the world. Why focus so much on the potentially destructive ones? Yeah. So in a very similar way, Rick Hansen, who wrote a great book, he's a neurobiologist, he wrote a book called The Buddha's Brain, and he writes a lot about the actual science of this practice, and he asks us to consciously lean in to a pleasant experience when we notice that it's happening for at least 30 seconds, okay? It's neurons that fire together, wire together, this idea. And so this means that we start to train the mind and body to not only start noticing more and more pleasant experiences when they happen, but to wire those feelings of happiness in the body to replace, literally replace, the feelings of fear and worry and despair, okay? So, for instance, when you notice that you're enjoying something, that's the first step, just notice that you're enjoying something. Like maybe the beautiful, something simple, like a smell of fall leaves and the sound of crunching. Like, oh, I really, that's kind of pleasant, right? Don't let it pass. Don't just keep going. Have it be a blip in the mind. Like, oh, that was kind of nice, right? Rick Hansen says to bask in the experience, soak it in, really feel and sense that good feeling in the mind and body. Let yourself enjoy it consciously. Remember, it's not that we're getting greedy and wanting more and more pleasant experiences, okay? Because that's definitely not the practice. That's greed. But when it happens, notice it. It's going to rise and pass just like everything else. It's that sacred pause. Ooh, okay, let me remember this. Because it's going to wire into the mind and the body. So when we notice something good or pleasant, maybe even a sense of love or kindness or compassion, again, we saturate ourselves in it rather than letting it pass by. In the same way, another excellent, excellent gratitude practice that helps with this is a gratitude journal. Anybody have one of those? Yeah, a lot of you. Good, 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 good. So clinical studies have actually shown, maybe this will be an encouragement, have shown that people who write down their gratitude for just 10 weeks, that their level of happiness increases 25% from the control group. 25%. Who wants to be 25% happier? Yeah. So this is a fantastic practice. And what it does is it trains our mind to focus on the good things. And this is because our mind has a built-in wanting tendency, right? And so what happens when we start writing in our journals, and I suggest you do this at night, Rick Hansen suggest that we do it at night. It helps the brain in some way remember it better. But when we do this, what happens is that we start getting a little greedy, actually, the next day, because it was so fun that we want more of it, right? It's like, it feels good. So we're like, okay, what can I be conscious of? Ooh, that was a great experience. I get to write that down. So the mind actually starts looking around for it. It starts looking for the good instead of looking for the negative, right? And also, it doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to take hours. Your gratitude journal can be like three things. You know, I suggest more, maybe like 12. And it can't be this. Don't add the same thing every day. Make it different, you know. It could even be something as simple sometimes when I'm doing it. It's just honestly, it's like I'm grateful for being able to write and the sound of this pen on the paper. I'm grateful for paper to write on, that someone made this. And then that goes on. I mean, it can just be little things. It doesn't have to be a gigantic, this is what I'm grateful for. But try not to add your cat in there every night, you know. So, as I do sometimes. And as you continue, you might even start paying attention to all those moments in your life that you actually consider boring. You know, those things that you do all the time. So like when you're turning water on in the faucet, you might imagine or remember what it would be like without water. You know, I'm so grateful I can just turn the switch and there's water. And then be grateful for all the things that water, you can do with water, you know. I need water to survive. I can drink it, but I can wash my dishes. I can wash my body. I can do all these things with water. And, you know, hot water, we didn't used to have that, right? And some people don't have that in the world. They don't have hot water. So what a luxury that is. You know? When you're reading, see if you can pause once in a while and rejoice in the fact that you can read, you know. And especially when I'm on retreat, I consciously practice gratitude during times of mindful eating. It's a real practice for me because it's amazing what can happen, you know. I always stop when I have, because I have time during a retreat. That's all you're doing is practicing. Say I have a bowl of oatmeal in the morning. I will hold the bowl of oatmeal, close my eyes and feel the heat and be grateful for that it's warming my hands. I'll be grateful for, you know, everything that was involved in creating the oatmeal for me. You know, somebody had to plant a seed and the plant had to grow and the sun and the water and someone had to harvest and package and cook this oatmeal for me and the water that went into it. And if there's, bless you, if there's, you know, meat on the table sometimes, I'll thank the bean that gave that meat and allowing me to have protein, or the egg or the dairy or whatever it is. Thank the animal, thank all the people, thank the person who made it. And then it gets crazy. Then it's like, thank whoever made this bowl and this table and this chair and all of it. You know, we honestly, it gets crazy, but it's, and then I send out a prayer to everybody. May all beings feel safe and warm and held and fed. So it's a great practice when you're eating to just have some gratitude rather than mindlessly eating and thinking about other things. You might also pause and celebrate your body in whatever condition it may be. You know, you can say thank you for having a body and an awake, aware, sentient, you know, I'm a sentient being alive in this moment. And you can do a bit of a body scan, you know, thank you feet, thank you, you know, legs, hips, you know, even my cranky knees, you know. Thank you, knees. They help me. They help me to walk. You know, if some part of your body isn't functioning well, rather than giving it less thanks, you can be especially grateful, you know. The body shows up for you every day and tries its best to serve you, even if it's not well or parts of it are injured. And it's always trying to repair itself and heal for you. And it's really kind of the best friend that you can have. It turns up to help you even when you are sick, you know. You can also, again, just start paying attention to every little thing around you and be thankful. Once you start this practice, it's just amazing, right? The furniture you're sitting on right now, you know, You ever think about that when you plunk yourself down in a chair? About the person, I mean, think about it. You don't really, right? We don't think about those things. Like, somebody paid for these church chairs. You know, somebody built them, put them together for you. The building we happen to be in, all the utilities that we have, the air, the sun, all of it. You might also take some time to be thankful for all the people in your life, many of whom you may really take for granted. I mean, I know when my husband left for a week and I had to do all his kind of chores and different things, and I didn't have him to talk to and just different things, you know, I just was suddenly really, really grateful for my husband, who I take for granted sometimes. And I don't recognize it until he actually wasn't there for me. So, you know, be grateful for the people in your life. And as you do this practice, you know, notice how you feel when you have gratitude. So, for instance, there might be some initial resistance, right? Maybe silly, sounds silly, some of the things that I'm mentioning here. You know, you may not want to acknowledge your innate dependence on other people or other things sometimes. But when you get into the practice of saying thank you, you might really start to notice that when you are grateful, what effect does that have on the body? So you might sense a feeling of warmth or softness around the heart, or even joy, or it can even bring up a sense of sadness. We can have tears. Like Liz was saying, she had tears for, she was so grateful for her birthday wishes. Like, it can bring up, gratitude can bring up just overwhelming, you know, gratitude can bring up tears. Might be helpful to remember that the Buddha said, a person of integrity is grateful and thankful. A person of integrity is grateful and thankful. So the idea is that the less we obsess about what's wrong with the world, and especially what's wrong with us, ourselves, the less we're going to feel out of place in the world and separate, which means the less we're going to feel conflicted and defensive, okay? Less fearful. This is because when our sense of being an isolated self, separate, is reduced, we really start to see more and more that we really are all in this together. We can't do it ourselves. And we start to see ourselves and others as essentially good, right? Rather than essentially, inherently, in some way, sinful or evil. We start seeing each other as essentially good. And we start feeling that within ourselves more and more, and believing that it's true, that we're essentially good. Great. Charles Shelton, who wrote The Gratitude Factor, wrote this. Individuals who feel interiorly a sense of their own goodness appear to possess an integrity that flows outwardly. They claim that a fundamental stance of goodness exists in the world. For them, the world is an inviting place that encourages them to spread and give away their own goodness. Okay. And again, this is really important, since when we see others as essentially good, we're going to hate less and therefore cause less harm and conflict. Okay. We're going to be more willing, when we see people as essentially good and ourselves as essentially good, we're going to be more willing to work for peace, right? Realizing that we all depend on one another, especially on our own innate goodness. So, for instance, just as an example of this and how important it is, you might imagine if everyone in the world not only hated themselves, but hated one another. Just imagine that. Everyone in the world hated themselves and hated one another. Nothing would get accomplished, would it? Right? Nothing would work. So it's not at all selfish. Not at all selfish to start being grateful for yourself and your life just as you are, just as it is right now, just as it is. And for all the ways that you're completely wonderful and awesome, you know, and for all the many ways that your life is working right now. So finally, it's also really important for a sense of balance to be grateful for our actual difficulties themselves, because again, these are our greatest teachers. This one's the hard one. You know, we can be grateful for things like a soft cat or other people in our lives, or you know, warm house, but try to be grateful for your difficulties. That one's a really hard one. But as most of you know through this practice, we're taught to bow to our difficulties and say thank you, because those, if we can stick with them, those are the things that are going to really transform us. They're our greatest teachers. So we bow the most deeply, actually, to our difficulties. So the great Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche once wrote, "All the things taking place around our world, all the irritations and all the problems are crucial. Without others, we cannot attain enlightenment. In fact, we cannot even tread on the path. If there is no noise outside during our sitting meditation, we cannot develop mindfulness. If we do not have aches and pains in the body, we cannot attain mindfulness. We cannot actually meditate. If everything were lovey-dovey and jellyfish-like, there would be nothing to work with." I love Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche is Pema Chodron's teacher, and they're in the Tibetan Shambhala tradition, which I started out in. And the reason I love them is that they're just so real and honest, and they just give you the shit up front. So finally, I'll end with one of my favorite quotes by the painter and illustrator Brian Andreas, who wrote, "Anyone can slay a dragon, but try waking up every morning and loving the world all over again. That's what takes a real hero." Okay. So in the time that we have left, I'm going to offer you just a very brief gratitude meditation. Just coming into a nice seated posture. Taking a nice deep breath in. Deep breath out. And those of you who'd like to, for as long as you'd like to, you can always place a hand on the heart, hand on the belly. Stick it in touch with the heart and the body. And connecting with the heart. Remembering that whenever we're feeling grateful for this body, this life, our lives, this is where we actually live. We live in this mind, body, heart right here. And so it can be helpful to be grateful for all the senses, for this living being, this body that we all are blessed to have. So you might even right now just place a slight smile in the eyes and the lips, just as a way to bring a sense of gratefulness, kindness. And I'm going to begin by inviting you to bring to mind a taste for which you feel grateful. With Thanksgiving coming up, maybe you can think of all your favorite things that you can taste and eat. And if you don't have a sense of taste, you might just have gratitude for just the fact of eating. Nourishing, nourishment, warmth, coolness, texture. And because it's the holidays, you might even have gratitude for whoever, even if it's yourself, maybe someone who makes your favorite food, if there's a connection there. Really letting yourself feel grateful. And if something comes to mind that's conflicting, let that go. And think of something you feel grateful for truly. Now go ahead and bring to mind a sound that you feel grateful for. It could be a loved one's voice, bird song, waves on the shore. Let yourself saturate in the sense of feeling grateful for being able to hear, or for whatever level of hearing you have. Now bring to mind a smell, something that you feel grateful to be able to smell. Again, maybe your favorite food or the smell of a loved one's clothing or skin. Maybe coffee in the morning, something in nature. Again, letting the eyes and the lips have a sense of a smile, the heart have a sense of a smile, gratitude. Now go ahead and bring to mind a sight that you're grateful that you're able to see. Again, it could be the face of a loved one, or a sunset, or painting. Maybe the moon, the sky. And sometimes it might be helpful to imagine that this is your last day on Earth. What would you want to remember? Have that much gratitude. Thank you for letting me see the moon or this person. Thank you. And finally, bringing to mind a touch that you feel grateful for, maybe a hug or the fur of a pet, something in nature, maybe a warm blanket, favorite piece of clothing. Could even be digging your hand in the dirt. Thank you. Thank you. And finally, just allowing yourself for the next minute or so to rest in the feeling of gratitude for this life that you've been given, this body, this precious life. You might bring to mind everything you feel grateful for. Just let whatever comes to mind arise and stay with it a little. Thank you. Thank you. Finally, listening to these words from Mary Oliver, who writes, "Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stone are forever in allegiance with gravity while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, 'Look,' and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads."